I saw Adam leave the garden with an apple in his hand. Now you're out, what are you gonna do? Plant my crops and pray for rain. Think I'll raise a little cane. I'm an orphan and I'm only passing through. Passing through, passing through. Sometimes happy, sometimes blue. Glad that I ran into you. Tell the people that you saw me passing through. I saw Jesus on that cross on the hill called Calvary. Do you hate mankind for what they did to you? He said, speak of love, not hate. There's things to do, it's growing late. I've so little time and I'm just passing through. Passing through, passing through. Sometimes happy, sometimes blue. Glad that I ran into you. Tell the people that you saw me passing through. I shivered with George Washington at Valley Forge that day. Why do your soldiers freeze here like they do? He said men will suffer, fight, even die for what is right, even though they know they're only passing through. Passing through, oh passing through. Sometimes happy, sometimes blue. Glad that I ran into you. Tell the people that you saw me passing through. I was at Franklin Roosevelt's side just a while before he died. He said one world must come out of World War II. Yankee, Russian, white or tan, Lord, a man is just a man. We're all brothers and we're only passing through. Passing through, passing through. Sometimes happy, sometimes blue. Glad that I ran into you. Tell the people that you saw me passing through. Well, I rode with old Abe Lincoln on that train to Gettysburg. I asked him, what are we gonna do? He said, every man must be unconditionally free, or there is no reason to be passing through. Passing through, oh, passing through. Sometimes happy, sometimes blue. Glad that I ran into you. Tell the people that you saw me passing through. I'm passing through, just passing through. Sometimes happy, sometimes blue. Glad that I ran into you. Tell the people that you saw me passing through.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program includes Speaking of Faith by American Public Media, The Moral Math of Climate Change from December 10, 2009, a conversation about climate change and moral imagination with a leading environmentalist and writer, Bill McKibben. The interview explores his evolving perspective on human responsibility in a changing natural world. This is about 50 minutes. And then after that, from the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark, on December 18, 2009, President Barack Obama. President Barack Obama addresses the world's leaders at COP15. This is about 11 minutes. And then after that, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change by Elizabeth Kohlberg. This is about 27 minutes.
We were both born in 1960. Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder if this era in which people like us went thousands of miles away to college or sent their children thousands of miles away to college, as a rite of passage backpacked through Europe or Latin America, that we didn't think twice about getting on an airplane to go on a business trip, right, or to see friends. Will this way of living with this kind of, is that going to go away? Like 100 years from now, will people look at some of this and just not believe that we live this way?
They may. I mean, I think we're going to have to learn to do a lot more travel via Google than American Airlines, we're going to have to learn to stretch our minds in different ways and learn to really fall in love with our local places. But I think that the best parts about the world that we've built are things that we can preserve. We're going to have to do have different ways of doing them. The best part of travel is the kind you describe, the backpack across Europe, not the visit to Club Med so you can just recreate your everyday life in a warmer spot, right. But even if you can't backpack across Europe, you can now have a relationship with someone in Europe in many ways more deeply and profoundly than it was easy anyway for someone of a couple of generations ago, because you can be in daily contact with them, hourly contact with them if you want. Skype is a very interesting, different way of being in touch with people and staying at home. I don't know how the world exactly is going to change. I know that the main features of the world we inhabit are the result of our access to cheap fossil fuel. That's why our cities sprawl. That's why we drive everywhere by ourselves, on and on and on. I know that that has to change, that physics and the negotiation that's underway internationally and whatever we think is between China and the U.S. and the EU. It's really not. The real negotiation underway is between human beings on the one hand and physics and chemistry on the other. That's a really tough negotiation because physics and chemistry are notoriously poor bargainers. They state their bottom line and that's it. Right. We're going to have no choice one way or another but to adapt, whether it's gracefully or in a violent and ugly fashion, to adapt to that demand of basic bottom line of the planet. But I think that we retain the capacity to do it in elegant and graceful ways. That's the hope anyway, but it really requires us to do it fast and with real commitment.
Elegantly but quickly.
That's it.
So, you've written about the sadness that descended on you as you wrote The End of Nature. And I wonder, you know so much about what's at stake here. And you have all these facts at your fingertips. I mean, do they haunt you?
I think the advantage of having written about this 20 years ago is that I've had 2 decades to work my way through whatever those cycles of grief and whatever that we, all the denial and bargaining and acceptance and yada, yada that you supposedly go through. I'm like on cycle 11 or whatever.
Okay.
I've had a lot of time. So, part of me is still completely haunted and sad. And part of me never takes a moment for granted. I love to ski in the winter, cross-country ski above all else. And there's not a day when I'm out skiing in the woods when I'm not thinking this is a gift and not something to be taken for granted, because it's not going to be here all that much longer probably. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I've gotten through enough of that that I can take enormous joy in the prospect of people coming together to do something about it.
Right.
I waited 20 years to see what the global warming movement would look like when it finally emerged. And it's beautiful. It's diverse. It's on both sides of the divide between rich and poor. It's from every faith around the world. It's young predominantly, but not completely. It's really, really wonderful. And that gives me an enormous charge of deep joy.
And you have a teenage daughter, is that right?
I do. I have a 16-year-old.
So what is the effect on her of living with you? And how does living with her make you think differently about how this will all go?
Well, of course, it raises the stakes in some other way emotionally, in powerful ways. And probably I don't even think about them that often because it's too intense and too hard. For her, she's a good Harry Potter fan, and there were several years when she referred to me as the Dark Lord because I was so
full of doom and gloom,
assiduous about turning out the lights. Just because I turned out the lights all the time.
Right.
But she's turned into a great activist. She went with me to India this past summer. We work together, and that's good fun. And most of the people I work with are all, 16 or between 16 and 25.
This is my last question. But, I say in my engagement with younger people, I also have a 16-year-old daughter, but also the people I am in conversation with, people I work with, I am very excited. I feel like they have a sensibility. They've grown up with the internet. They have a completely different imagination.
Absolutely.
I mean, and technologically and morally somehow. Globalization isn't an abstract concept. It's something they know in their being. Do you also...
So,
yeah.
so, So I, you know, with seven Middlebury College students and essentially almost no money, we organized the biggest day of political action in the planet's history. And it's because they had a visceral, intuitive sense of how to use technology, how people are connected. They didn't just send e-petitions to each other.
Yeah.
They used it to organize people on the ground in real life to do things. But they live in a different mental space and a much, in many ways, much more promising one that goes way beyond national boundaries and at the same time has room for deep. It's both deep and local and wide and global at the same time. And let's hope that it's come in time. Let's hope we got some of this going in time. It'll be an interesting race to see where it comes out. And we will find out. I mean, it's not going to be 100 years in the future before we figure out whether we dealt with global warming or not. We'll know in the next few years whether we started to take steps on the scale necessary. It's an exciting, scary, intense moment. It's for our time. You know, we grew up looking backwards at, say, the civil rights movement
or something.
And admiring the people who had the courage and conviction to go put everything on the line and do it then. For our time, this is, you know, requires the same moral urgency, the same kind of sacrifice, the same kind of theological rethinking, the same kind of practical change. It's that kind of moment on steroids because it's about the whole planet.
Bill McKibben is a scholar in residence in environmental studies at Middlebury College and the founder of 350.org. His books include The End of Nature and Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. In writing the script for this program, we faced some hurdles in understanding, explaining, and simply fact-checking the particulars of climate change. On our production blog, SOF Observed, we give you behind-the-scenes stories and sources of our information. I encourage you to read about our efforts and contribute your own knowledge and experience. We look forward to reading those comments. And as you're listening to this program, you may also be feeling inundated by the news coming out of the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark. We want to sustain this conversation in the months following the summit, and in the terms Bill McKibben spoke about, to invite reflection on how climate change will change the substance of our lives, and how it might alter what the world means spiritually, psychologically, philosophically. How have changing realities of the natural world touched you at a practical and moral level? On our homepage, look for the Share Your Story link and tell us. And download an MP3 of this program along with my complete, unedited conversation with Bill McKibben at speakingoffaith.org.
So glad morning when this life is over. Fly away to a home on God's celestial shore. Fly away, oh glory. I die, hallelujah.
seeds all die. I'm gonna fly. No more burners, no more lynchings. I'm gonna fly.
Good morning. It is an honor for me to join this distinguished group of leaders from nations around the world. We come here in Copenhagen because climate change poses a grave and growing danger to our people. All of you would not be here unless you, like me, were convinced that this danger is real. This is not fiction. It is science. Unchecked, climate change will pose unacceptable risks to our security, our economies, and our planet. This much we know. The question then before us is no longer the nature of the challenge. The question is our capacity to meet it. For while the reality of climate change is not in doubt, I have to be honest. As the world watches us today, I think our ability to take collective action is in doubt right now. And it hangs in the balance. I believe we can act boldly and decisively in the face of a common threat. That's why I come here today, not to talk, but to act. Now, as the world's largest economy and as the world's second largest emitter, America bears our responsibility to address climate change. And we intend to meet that responsibility. That's why we've renewed our leadership within international climate change negotiations. That's why we've worked with other nations to phase out fossil fuel subsidies. That's why we've taken bold action at home, by making historic investments in renewable energy, by putting our people to work, increasing efficiency in our homes and buildings, by pursuing comprehensive legislation to transform to a clean energy economy. These mitigation actions are ambitious, and we are taking them not simply to meet global responsibilities. We are convinced, as some of you may be convinced, that changing the way we produce and use energy is essential to America's economic future, that it will create millions of new jobs, power new industries, keep us competitive, and spark new innovation. We're convinced, for our own self-interest, that the way we use energy, changing it to a more efficient fashion, is essential to our national security because it helps to reduce our dependence on foreign oil and helps us deal with some of the dangers posed by climate change. So I want this plenary session to understand America is going to continue on this course of action to mitigate our emissions and to move towards a clean energy economy, no matter what happens here in Copenhagen. We think it is good for us as well as good for the world. But we also believe that we will all be stronger, all be safer, all be more secure if we act together. That's why it is in our mutual interest to achieve a global accord in which we agree to certain steps and to hold each other accountable to certain commitments. After months of talk, after 2 weeks of negotiations, after innumerable side meetings, bilateral meetings, endless hours of discussion among negotiators, I believe that the pieces of that accord should now be clear. First, all major economies must put forward decisive national actions that will reduce their emissions and begin to turn the corner on climate change. I'm pleased that many of us have already done so. Almost all the major economies have put forward legitimate targets, significant targets, ambitious targets. And I'm confident that America will fulfill the commitments that we have made, cutting our emissions in the range of 17% by 2020 and by more than 80% by 2050 in line with final legislation. Second, we must have a mechanism to review whether we are keeping our commitments and exchange this information in a transparent manner. These measures need not be intrusive or infringe upon sovereignty. They must, however, ensure that an accord is credible and that we're living up to our mutual obligations. Without such accountability, any agreement would be empty words on a page. I don't know how you have an international agreement where we all are not sharing information and ensuring that we are meeting our commitments. That doesn't make sense. It would be a hollow victory. Number three, we must have financing that helps developing countries adapt, particularly the least developed and most vulnerable countries, to climate change. America will be a part of a fast start funding that will ramp up to $10 billion by 2012. And yesterday, Secretary Hillary Clinton, my Secretary of State, made it clear that we will engage in a global effort to mobilize $100 billion in financing by 2020, if and only if it is part of a broader accord that I've just described. Mitigation, transparency, financing. It's a clear formula, one that embraces the principle of common but differentiated responses and respective capabilities. And it adds up to a significant accord, one that takes us farther than we have ever gone before as an international community. I just want to say to this plenary session that we are running short on time. And at this point, the question is whether we will move forward together or split apart, whether we prefer posturing to action. I'm sure that many consider this an imperfect framework that I just described. No country will get everything that it wants. There are those developing countries that want aid with no strings attached and no obligations with respect to transparency. They think that the most advanced nations should pay a higher price. I understand that. There are those advanced nations who think that developing countries either cannot absorb this assistance, or that will not be held accountable effectively, and that the world's fastest growing emitters should bear a greater share of the burden. We know the fault lines because we've been imprisoned by them for years. These international discussions have essentially taken place now for almost two decades, and we have very little to show for it other than an increase, acceleration of the climate change phenomenon. The time for talk is over. This is the bottom line. We can embrace this accord, take a substantial step forward, continue to refine it, and build upon its foundation. We can do that, and everyone who is in this room will be part of a historic endeavor, one that makes life better for our children and our grandchildren. Or we can choose delay, falling back into the same divisions that have stood in the way of action for years. And we will be back having the same stale arguments month after month, year after year, perhaps decade after decade, all while the danger of climate change grows until it is irreversible. Ladies and gentlemen, there's no time to waste. America's made our choice. We have charted our course. We have made our commitments. We will do what we say. Now I believe it's the time for the nations and the people of the world to come together behind a common purpose. We are ready to get this done today. But there has to be movement on all sides to recognize that it is better for us to act than to talk. It's better for us to choose action over inaction, the future over the past. And with courage and faith, I believe that we can meet our responsibilities to our people and the future of our planet. Thank you very much.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.